Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. Now, this is David Silkenet, and always in Edinburgh, and this time I'm actually joined by Frank, who has gotten back from his prodigious road trip going all over the United States. You were in New York and Massachusetts and California and all kinds of places, but now you're back here?
I'm back!
And we're recording this episode for those people who want to stalk us in the Cameo Bar, which is a nice establishment in close proximity both to our place of work and our domicile, so nice triangulation here. And Frank's drinking some cider, and I, of course, am drinking some whiskey here. We are recording this on the afternoon of Good Friday, so the 14th of April. Just like the NPR podcast, you got to actually have a timestamp here to make sure that 5 minutes is all going to be out of date. So we've got two topics today, both in some ways related to Trump's foreign policy and his policy on the Middle East in particular. And the first has to do with his stance on war in Syria. About a week ago, he ordered a launch of missiles on a Syrian airbase. And this is after campaigning for president, and even before the campaign, being critical of U.S. involvement in Syria. Now that he's taken office, he seems to be changing that. Our second topic, we're going to look at war powers and look at the history of the relationship between the president and Congress over who has authority to get us involved militarily, the president as commander-in-chief, and Congress with the power to declare war, and look at the tensions there and look at the conflict with Syria in that context, in that lens. So, Frank, with our first topic, this is not the first time a president has campaign saying they're going to keep us out of war and then getting into office and change their mind. Can you think of any precedents for this?
Well, we can, although I think the first thing we need to bear in mind, David, is it's as yet unclear how engaged Trump is, and thus the United States is, in the Syrian war.
Sure.
As to whether the missile attack last week, I mean, they launched 59 cruise missiles on that Syrian airbase, whether that was a represents a newfound American commitment to the Syrian war and a new, deeper level of engagement, or whether it was a kind of impetuous response of the kind that Trump, military version of one of his tweet storms? But having said that, to address your question, and that simply remains to be seen.
Sure.
And there's been a lot of rhetoric in the week since then about Syria. We also had the dropping of the so-called mother of all bombs in Afghanistan yesterday.
Yeah.
And a lot of talk about tension in Korea. So one of the things that, troubling Korea, if you will, and one of the things that, you're absolutely right, one of the things that Trump stated when he was running for president was he was going to put America first, and the implication of that, and he was very critical of what he saw as military adventurism by both of his immediate predecessors, Presidents Obama and Bush, and he signaled during the campaign that he would be different in this regard. And you're right, the rhetoric of the past couple of weeks suggests, and the actions of the past couple of weeks suggest otherwise. And so we're in a situation where we're going to consider whether presidents have done this before.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess one of the sort of earliest examples of this is with, you know, World War One. Wilson, when he's running for re-election in 1916, was, you know, the Americans saw the war in Europe, and Wilson very much ran in that campaign as about keeping us out of the war. We can think of another example then in World War II, where FDR is running for re-election in 1940 while the war is going on in Europe, saying he's going to keep us out of war. So I think this is actually a phenomenon that happens a lot, where somebody campaigns on kind of an isolationist tendency, and then as soon as they take office, you know, their tone shifts on that, and sometimes it shifts very quickly.
Well, and even more recently, LBJ ran on anti-war rhetoric, and of course became deeply enmeshed in Vietnam. Even Nixon claimed in 1968 to have a secret plan to end the war, and that secret plan seemed to be escalating the war.
Sure.
I mean, that's slightly different because the war was ongoing at that point. But you're right, this does seem to be a pronounced pattern.
Yeah, I think, you know, American voters, I think, you know, what all those things have in common is they want a strong military, but they very rarely vote for somebody who explicitly says they're going to get them into war, who they suspect is going to be more likely to get the United States involved in war. So if you think about 64, Barry Goldwater could have got this label as being, you know, trigger happy and very willing to use the military all over the globe, and whether he was going to use, you know, atomic weapons. And you know, part of Johnson's victory in that election was because of that. And you see the same thing with, you know, in 1916 and in 1940.
Well, let's face it. Considering all the people who've run for president over the past 225 or 30 years or so, very few have run on a platform of "I'm going to get you into war." And the one we can think of is James K. Polk.
Where Polk says, in, you know, when he's running in 1844, he's talking about acquiring a large amount of territory from Mexico, and he says he's going to buy it, and they do offer to buy it, but there's hints that if they don't accept the offer, there's going to be military action. And then the same with the Oregon Territory. We talked about 54-40 or fight. You know, that military, you know, option was on the table with Polk, whereas, you know, Henry Clay was much more reticent about either annexing Texas or engaging in military activity. But that's really the exception.
That is. Sorry, David. Before we go on, could you explain to people what that 54-40? Oh,
okay. So there was
fight.
Sure. So the boundary between the United States and British Canada was in dispute in the Pacific Northwest. What exactly the United States controlled as a consequence of Louisiana Purchase was in some dispute. And so there's this large sort of region in what is now Oregon, Washington, and in British Columbia that was both claimed by Britain and by the British Canada and by the United States. Polk said, look, we're going to try and push and get the northern border, the boundary of what the United States claimed. They actually end up not doing that. They end up settling for basically continuing the border line that existed east and continuing all the way to the Pacific Ocean, splitting it where it is now.
The 49th parallel as opposed to the 54th parallel.
Yes, yeah, exactly. But, I mean, that's one of the few cases where somebody runs on a fairly explicit platform about taking military action.
You're right about that. Polk is the outlier, but yeah. and perhaps not terribly relevant in this case.
Yes.
So I think the examples of Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt are interesting because you're correct. They explicitly ran on, we're going to keep you out of war. Mm. I do wonder whether
and
FDR
George W.
really believed that. Oh, sorry.
And George W. Bush did to some degree as well. You know, he said, well, "We're not going to get involved in foreign wars. We're going to let the rest of the world take care of itself." You know, and in each of these cases, there was a, you know, precipitating event, I think, that once they're in office, changed their perspective on that. So, you know, in World War One, you know, the Zimmerman telegraph, I think.
Telegram.
You send a telegraph, you get a telegram. Right. Good. Exactly. That note, I think, which actually connected to Polk in a way with what Mexico wanted to reclaim or what Germany was offering to help them reclaim, you know, was there the straw that broke the camel's back with regards to U.S. involvement in World War One? Obviously, Pearl Harbor is a much more explicit case of the United States, you know, before Pearl Harbor, saying it's not going to get involved, at least not directly, although you've got the Lend-Lease Act and those kinds of things. To taking active military action. Likewise with, you know, with Vietnam, you've got, you know, I guess the Gulf of Tonkin incident, you know, as a precipitating, you know, factor for further U.S. involvement.
So David, does this suggest that people lie when they run for president, or is it that when they enter into office, it turns out the world's a much more complicated place than they realized, and as you say, exogenous events occur and presidents have to respond to them?
I think it's actually probably more, it's some of both, I think. So, I mean, Trump said here with this case, the thing that changed his mind was when he saw images of Syrian children being gassed.
Yes, he's very concerned about beautiful babies.
Babies, yes. Innocent babies.
Innocent babies. He won't let them into the country, of course
exactly.
Refugees.
But the innocent babies, as long as they stay over there, we're going to take care of them by don't know. That's a different rant. But, you know, now obviously there have been lots of innocent babies killed in Syria over the past...
Who weren't killed by chemical weapons.
Or some that were killed by chemical weapons during the Obama administration, but also by, you know, cluster bombs and all the kinds of matters of horror that have been going on. So you know, it seems odd that he cites that as his justification or his sort of rationale for changing his mind. You know, I think there's an apprehension when you're in that office of not taking action and appearing weak on a global stage and on a sort of national political stage. And I think that may be as much as anything about why people, you know, would go from an isolationist stance to a more aggressive internationalist stance.
Well, let's not forget the old cliche that, you know, when you're carrying a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
No, to be sure.
I mean, when you're president of the United States, and we'll get to this in our second topic, yeah. I suppose, you've got this incredibly powerful military at your disposal, and the temptation to use it and to see it as a solution to problems must be very, very compelling. Yeah. Although that wasn't the case for Wilson, certainly, in 1960. And even FDR.
Yeah.
I mean, the U.S. military was nothing compared to what it is then, compared to what it is today.
In terms of having standing military,
I mean, so in that sense, the temptation to use the force at your disposal, particularly in response to events, must be quite profound. I do think, I wonder with Trump, though, and President Trump's action last week, actions over the past week, if the appropriate analogy isn't LBJ and or Nixon in Vietnam, in the sense that those two presidents, upon taking office, might have been sincerely committed to trying to de-escalate those conflicts and extract the United States from them, but having inherited an ongoing conflict, it was very difficult to do so.
Yeah.
And I wonder if what Trump is discovering is, although the United States hadn't been formally engaged in Syria, although he's also sent ground troops to Syria in the past few weeks, and that's gone relatively unremarked. But having inherited a conflict in the wider Middle East that's been going on now for 15 years, or 16 years.
Or 70 years.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
you know, he found himself extricating the United States from that. You know, saying America first is one thing, and make America great and all this kind of thing. But actually, once...
Governing's a lot harder than running,
Yes, that's right. Governing is harder than winning. And therefore, he felt compelled to respond. I also think this reflects one of the things we've seen in the past week is an interesting power struggle within the administration, at least if the media reports would be to believe, between kind of Steve Bannon from Breitbart, who's much more on the Make America Great isolationist end of the spectrum, and the more conventional foreign policy security types like General Mattis and Jared Kushner even, who I think might have won this debate. And there's there were reports this week that Steve Bannon might be on his way out. And it may reflect that. And so the administration is becoming more conventional, if you will. And Trump, the other day, he had a remarkable news conference with the NATO Secretary General, in which he suddenly, having previously
trashed NATO over and over again,
and claimed it was obsolete and past its sell-by date and everything else, was sort of saying this is cornerstone of our defense and everything else. So we may have seen, I mean, we've been talking about pivots for too long with Trump, and he could easily pivot in another direction, but in foreign policy terms, he may have taken both a more bellicose term, but also a more conventional term in the past turn in the past week.
Well, it's always curious how often he says, you know, he met with you know, Premier of China, and he supposedly said that after a 10-minute conversation where the Premier of China explained the complexity of North Korea to him, he's like, I didn't realize it was that complex, which is kind of scary that he didn't know North Korea was that complex, but, you know, it seems to be having a interesting learning curve. One thing that's happened that he said in the past week that struck me has to do with his use of pronouns. And I don't know whether you picked up on this. When he talks about the military, he's been repeatedly using it talking about my military.
Yes, that's right.
Instead of the way most presidents describe it, our military, which I think is a interesting linguistic trait of his. I'm not sure, you know, I mean, I don't want to read too much into that in terms of how he thinks about the relationship between the president and the military as commander-in-chief, but it seems from that phrasing that... you know, he feels like he has the autonomy to do pretty much whatever he wants, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the Trumpian view of the world, it's my military and your media. But
exactly.
But and to some extent, this relates to our second topic in talking about presidential war powers. But because I'm not sure he has a necessarily a deep understanding of the Constitution.
Yeah.
He probably does see it as his military to some extent. But, and let's not forget, he's suffered a really, really substantial setback in domestic policy, politics a few weeks ago on health care. And one of the things we see is presidents have far more authority over foreign policy. And particularly as commander-in-chief, the president has a great deal of authority. And they can do things in the foreign realm in a way they struggle to do things domestically. And so the desire to act might have been one of the things that motivated him. I mean, I don't think he sort of said he necessarily thought of it in those terms. One of the things that concerns me, I think, and this is a danger we see with a lot of presidents, is military action, at least initially, is often popular because people rally around the flag and everything else. He hasn't seen that much of a boost in the polls as a result of this action, but
he's got some.
In the day or 24 or 36 hours immediately after the Tomahawk missile strikes in Syria, he did get pretty good press.
Yes.
And he was described as being presidential and all that sort of thing. And it's hard to believe that he wouldn't respond to that. And indeed, the use of this, mother of all bombs yesterday in Afghanistan, I can't help but wonder if that wasn't a partial motivation for that. He may be finding military action easy.
I'm deeply worried that he's somebody who cares about ratings, and if he thinks his ratings go up when he bombs things, he's going to bomb more things.
Exactly. And I think that's a real danger.
It's not a good feedback loop.
Not least because there's real tension in the Korean Peninsula right now, and a war there could be, could have grievous implications globally.
To be sure. All right. On that note, let's go on to verge of World War III. Let's move on to topic two, which actually we've touched on slightly here about the relationship between the president and Congress over for who has authority to wage war. There was some complaints in Congress last week after the attack and the bombing, the missile strike in Syria, that Congress wasn't appropriately consulted before this happened. In fact, Trump, when he was running for president, said that if Obama was going to strike Syria, he should get congressional approval first. Frank, do you want to give us the brief constitutional rundown of who has what powers with regards to war?
Well, this is more complicated than it seems, David, because the Constitution, of course, vests the authority to declare war in Congress. And you'll be pleased to know that the United States Congress hasn't declared war on anyone since
1942.
That's right. So we've been at peace since then. because Congress hasn't declared war on anyone. So the Korean War wasn't a declared war by Congress, nor was Vietnam, nor the First Gulf War, or so on and so forth. And so Congress has the authority to declare war, and it also has the authority to approve the budgets, military budgets. Yeah. So that's how it exercises its authority. The president, as commander-in-chief, has the authority to command the military of the United States. And so what's happened is that, particularly during the Cold War, with the end of the Second World War in 1945, during the Cold War, we saw the rise of what Arthur Schlesinger, among others, dubbed the Imperial Presidency. Where in foreign policy terms, and particularly with regard to military policy, presidents exercise increased authority, often without resort to Congress or with limited resort to Congress. And Congress has tended to more or less surrender that authority to the president as a result. And this happened from about 1945 until 1973, when Congress struck back with the so-called War Powers Act. And the War Powers Act was adopted in 1973 over the veto of President Nixon, which meant that both houses of Congress had to override that veto. The War Powers Act was intended to limit the president's authority to deploy the U.S. military abroad, and this was meant to limit Richard Nixon's in particular, Richard Nixon's authority in particular, because Nixon, in seeking to prosecute and supposedly end the Vietnam War, had broadened that conflict into Cambodia more or less without anybody's knowledge or approval. And so the War Powers Act stipulates that when the president deploys the U.S. military, he can only do so without congressional approval in advance in response to an emergency. Mm-hmm. And it has to be an emergency that threatens the security of the United States. Even when he does that, he must inform Congress within 48 hours. Mm-hmm. And the military action should be limited to 60 days, with another 30 days to
withdraw troops.
So he's got 3 months, essentially. From the time that Congress has been notified. Notification of Congress has taken many forms. It normally takes the form of informing the so-called Gang of Eight, who are the leaders from both parties of the major committees in Congress associated with defense and security matters. So the intelligence committees and the foreign affairs committees and the defense committee and things like that. And normally by informing those people who've been read into and properly vetted in terms of their security clearances. Although Devin Nunez has such a clearance, so one has to wonder about the vetting. And so congressional approval is usually given after the fact, or sometimes in advance of action, where the Gang of Eight are concerned. And so this has been intended to limit the scope of the president as far as deploying U.S. force. To be honest, though, since 1973... the presidents of both parties have gradually but steadily acquired more and more authority, and more often than not exceeded the War Powers Act, it seems. So President Reagan sent Marines to Lebanon, and they stayed for 18 months in 1982 and 83.
Yeah.
In 2011, President Obama sent troops who were active in Libya for longer than stipulated by the War Powers Act. Yeah. Before that, President
Clinton did this bombings in the former Yugoslavia.
Yeah. Particularly since 9/11, we've seen extended military deployments in various parts of the wider Middle East, of course. And so I think Trump's action needs to be seen in that context. The other thing is, since 9/11 and the advent of the so-called War on Terror, we've seen a blurring of intelligence and military policy. And so the surveillance of people at home and abroad, and then acting on intelligence gathered by surveillance with very little oversight, has increased. And we've seen that under Presidents Bush and Obama, and now under President Trump.
I mean, the thing about the War Powers Act is it's not entirely clear it's enforceable. If the president exceeds his authority on the War Powers Act, there's not a mechanism through which Congress can really stop him other than impeachment. There isn't other war cutting the budget for the military, which
no congressman is ever going to cut the budget for the military because they'll get crucified in the next election.
So and that cycle is too slow to actually have meaningful. You know, so it's a symbolic sort of restraint as much as anything.
You tweeted today that we need a new War Powers Act, David. What do you have in mind?
Well, I think we need to actually have... First, I'm concerned with... You know, after 9/11, they passed a sort of authorization for military activity that said, you know, that the president had the authority to use the military to attack the people... to get the people who committed 9/11 and the people who harbor them. Fine. I'm okay with that when it means getting Al-Qaeda, getting, you know, the Taliban, who's harboring them, what have you. But it's been used since then to basically justify all military activity anywhere with anybody that doesn't, you know, who is Muslim, who has sort of terrorist methodologies. So, you know, they use that as justification yesterday for hitting an ISIS associate in Afghanistan. Well, ISIS didn't exist at 9/11, so they can't have harbored or supported that attack as an organization because they didn't exist. You know, so there's ways in which Congress sort of creates these blankets that the president can then use for whatever
And the conflict has extended to Yemen and the Horn of Africa.
And the same is true, I think, you know, with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution where, before the War Powers Act in Vietnam where Congress said, you know, in response to this episode in the Gulf of Tonkin, the president has the power to basically do whatever the hell he wants. And Congress, in some ways, I find is sort of, rejecting its own sort of authority to actually may have a meaningful voice in these kinds of questions. The other way, though, I think...
Sorry, David, if I can interrupt you before you go on. So is the problem Congress or the president?
Well, I think
the presidency?
Well, I think it's both, and I also think there's ways in which war has changed since the War Powers Act to make these things make a difference. So thinking about the missiles in Syria. First, Syria wasn't... The Syrian regime didn't, you know, so how would that sort of fits into any sort of justification?
It wasn't actively threatening the United States.
So... And you didn't have Tomahawk missiles in 1973. You know, so you didn't have that kind of warfare. You had, you know, the War Powers Act talks about American troops on the ground, essentially, and withdrawing the troops. Well, you can launch missiles at somebody and then say, oh, we stopped. And then you can start again. And then you can stop. And then you can start again. Well, all those are discrete activities. It's not boots on the ground. Likewise, with drone warfare, we're killing people in countries where we're not actually even sending people. You know, how does the War Powers Act sort of function?
You don't withdraw the drones after 60 days.
Yeah, you withdraw them after, you know, a couple hours. And you don't have to, you know, it talks about withdrawing troops. Well, there are no troops. The troops are in a, you know, hangar in North Dakota commanding the drones that are, you know, in Yemen or something.
Again, so, you with North Dakota. Your North Dakota obsession.
No, no, they had lots of the drone pilots were in North Dakota, and I would see them in the diner, and they'd be like going off to like go and command drones someplace, and then they go and have coffee and mediocre pancakes.
So technology has changed.
So I mean, I don't think the tools, you know, the sort of the constraints that are placed upon it, you know, where it talks about 60 days and an extra 30 days, like all that makes sense in a 1973 world. Where you actually have, you know, large-scale land war kinds of things. It doesn't totally make sense in a world where the president would say, fine, I'm going to go and kill these people and those people and blow this thing up because I have, you know, the tools that allow me to do that without consulting Congress beforehand. And if I tell them afterwards, I don't have to tell them afterwards because it's on CNN anyway.
So how would you? I mean, I want to go back. There is one historic precedent I want to talk about. But if we had a new War Powers Act, how would it look?
I would think you can't engage in a military conflict in another country without congressional approval first. You know, except in the cases where the American safety is legitimately threatened. So you know.
Okay, the international lawyers are going to argue endlessly over what legitimate means.
Yeah, but I'm
so sure, an imminent threat.
An imminent, you know, but clearly, you know, Assad is not an imminent threat to the United States. I think anybody who would, you know, make that argument would, you know, would have a difficult time sort of persuading anybody of that.
Interestingly, Rand Paul, the libertarian senator from Kentucky, who has been a real apologist for President Trump in ways that are really surprising, frankly, to me. This is where he broke with Trump. So last week...
Well, he's always been an isolationist.
Yeah, he is an isolationist. And he essentially said, this is not an imminent... The gas attack last week does not constitute an imminent threat to the United States, and therefore the War Powers Act doesn't apply, and this action was illegal. Congress should have been warned in advance. It should have been notified.
Well, it's an act of war on a foreign country, you know, which is... You know, according to sort of UN rules, not kosher either. But I don't want to be crafting the policy, but I think we need to have sort of more constraints on the presidency. You know, if we take if we say that Congress has a role, and I think Congress should have a role. We need to sort of define what that role is. I mean, if we want to think, though, about sort of the president using military power unilaterally, we've talked about it a lot in a more recent context, but there actually is a huge amount of precedent for presidents using the military without congressional approval. And do you want to...
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorites in this, of course, is my guy Jefferson. Going back to the so-called First Barbary War and the outbreak of that conflict in 1801... and what happens is really, really instructive, I think, because here we have it, and it's a totally different world, and the technology is very different. In this case, the technology of communication. And so Jefferson was inaugurated as president in March of 1801. And in May, and when he was inaugurated, there was a widespread belief, for reasons I won't go into now, that a possible conflict... and even war might break out between the United States and Tripoli, modern Libya, over trade and so on. The reasons don't need to need not detain us here.
For full details, see Frank's book on
the subject. Yeah, there you go. But do not see Brian Kilmeade's book, which is awful. Jefferson met with his cabinet. Well, on May 14th, 1801, the Pasha of Tripoli, Yusuf Karamanli, ordered the American flag cut down outside of the American consulate in Tripoli, and this was seen as a declaration of war. On May 15th, the next day, Jefferson met with his cabinet. Now, that was a coincidence that these two events took place so close together, because, of course, there was no instantaneous communication in 1801. But Jefferson and his cabinet debated what to do in the event of a Tripolitan declaration of war, which they expected. And the cabinet was unanimous that Jefferson should dispatch the U.S. Navy, or elements of the U.S. Navy, to the Mediterranean to wage war on Tripoli in the event of that occurrence. And Jefferson asked the constitutional question. He said, look, Congress isn't in session. Do I have the authority to do this? Or does the cabinet believe I have the authority? And the cabinet was unanimous in the view that in the event that Tripoli took action against the United States, Jefferson had to respond, and he need not call Congress into session.
Okay.
That he, as president...
So if they declare war on us, everything...
A state of war exists. Yeah. That's exactly what the minutes of the meeting say. And that kind of complied with Jefferson's appreciation of the Constitution. And so Jefferson essentially was taking upon, as president, this is the first time we see this in an overseas conflict, was taking on the authority to wage war without a congressional declaration of war in response to an attack, I'm using air quotes here, or inverted commas, an attack on the United States. Now, one can argue that what the Tripolitans did in declaring war was actually seek to negotiate with the United States in open negotiations, but that's another matter. But Jefferson therefore dispatched the Navy. And his view and the view of his cabinet was, well, when Congress comes back into session in December, 8 months hence, or 7 months hence, they can...
Retroactively,
They will approve the action if they vote the funding to support it. And so this is quite a modern moment, if you will, where the president is taking upon himself war powers.
Well, the other times... when this happens is the fact the United States is constantly in war throughout the 19th century with Native Americans.
Right, and that was true in the 1790s as well.
So, you know, for throughout the history of the United States up until 1890 or so, the United States is really in a constant state of warfare, but they never declare war because they don't see the Native Americans as legitimate actors upon which to declare war, and so congressional approval is never needed beyond the funding for the army.
That's right. They're not recognized as kind of actors in kind of international relations.
You know,
They're not recognized as nation states.
Yeah.
And Tripoli's a little bit like that as well.
Well, and more recently things like Al Qaeda, where you say we're declaring war on terrorist organizations, they're not nation states, and so you don't
have non-state
actors. And so you have different rules apply. At least that's what their lawyers claim.
Yeah. But you're right to point that out because there's actually a long tradition of that. Particularly if one looks at the conflicts with Native Americans at the turn of the 20th century, the insurgency in the Philippines, and so on. So, yeah, there's a long...
And lots of interventions in Latin American countries where Congress smiles and nods and the president does what he wants under Taft and under Wilson.
So in this sense, the action that President Trump took last week is much more in keeping with American traditions, despite claims to the contrary. Is that a fair statement?
It's interesting how rarely Congress actually exercises its power to declare war. You know, and I think it's, you know, some people say it's passé that declaring war is sort of an antiquated notion anyway, especially during the Cold War when the thought that, you know, you could declare war and 6 minutes later the world would end. I'm not quite sure whether I want to sort of follow completely down that road that the Congress's role is basically just to sign the checks that the president has already, you know, put it in debt for. But it does seem like there's a long tradition of the president acting unilaterally and then sort of assuming Congress is going to back him on it.
Well, the U.S. has been at war almost constantly, or at least has been engaged in military action since the creation of the Republic.
Republic, yeah. Switzerland, we are not.
Yeah, indeed. Yet it's only declared war a handful of times.
Times, yeah.
So what we're thinking? We're thinking 1812, 1846,
1917. No,
1898. Of course, 1898, 1917, 1941 and
2. Yeah, and that would be it. Which is, you know, clearly only a small handful of the wars the United States has been in.
So it's not just the imperial presidency.
No, I think there's a longer history to it than that.
Right, right.
All right. I think we're time for our last drop, Frank. What do you got?
Right. On my flight the other day, David, I was looking for a movie.
You're flying United.
I was flying United. United. In fact, that's a different last drop. I did think about talking about that. I'm not going to. Well, we could talk about United Airlines, but speaking of undeclared war. Actually, it is worth saying that has to be the biggest public relations disaster. Well, sing Sean Spice. Anyway, I was flying United, and I was looking at the array of movies on offer. And, of course, the vast majority of popular movies at the moment are superhero films. And they're filming the new Avengers movie here in Edinburgh now, so superhero movies are on our mind. However, I like a good superhero movie as much as the next person, but I chose to watch the remake of The Magnificent Seven, and this proved to be a terrible mistake. I actually like westerns. I realize I'm trending old for our demographic, but there you go.
We have a demographic?
I don't know whether we have a demographic. Well, we're very popular in North Dakota. They probably like westerns. And so I chose to watch The Magnificent Seven, the remake of The Magnificent Seven that came out in the past year.
Yeah.
With Denzel Washington in the lead and Chris Pratt. And first of all, it was terrible. Secondly, it was reminiscent of those old World War II movies where there's a kind of ethnically diverse platoon that represents the country. And so the Seven that are defending the small town were, you know, there was a Chinese individual, there was a Mexican guy. They're led by Denzel Washington, who's African American. There were different kind of ethnic groups that were prominent in the West in the 19th century. Which was, there was a Native American who's with them, prominent in the 19th century. And on one hand, I thought, oh, this is great. It's not a Western like in the 1950s and 60s when everybody's white, except the Indians were always bad.
Yes, yeah.
But everybody was so stereotypical. So the Chinese guy fought with knives. Native American is firing arrows all the time. And I couldn't finish it, actually. I turned it off. But it did make me reflect. There was a time 50 or 60 years ago when the Western was the dominant genre in Hollywood, as dominant as the superhero film is today. And it seems that we're likely to be confronted with an endless stream of superhero movies for the foreseeable future. But that too shall pass.
Yes.
It's hard to believe that, but it too shall pass. I think. And then watching a bad Western was a reminder of the time when there were good Westerns, and it was the dominant genre.
Well, I think, you know, with Westerns, it was all about, one of the major themes of Westerns is, you know, there were good guys and bad guys, who would other them, and there were all these sort of racial, you know, ways in which that
worked. Well, Westerns and superhero movies are very similar.
Well, but in some senses, but, you know, the enemy is always like an alien, but the human characteristics of the other is different. I think we're less comfortable now watching the Westerns from the 1950s where they're going in and fighting Indians than we film watchers in the 1950s would.
No, but some of the greatest films in Hollywood history,
sure,
and some really significant landmarks like The Searchers, invert the tropes and challenge them and go to, you know, which happens with great works of art. So I'm thinking of The Searchers, I'm thinking of My Darling Clementine, I'm thinking of High Noon, which is really a brilliant film about McCarthyism and conformity in the 1950s. I mean, the very best Westerns, not the hotel chain best Western, the very best Westerns, of course,
you've been on the road too long.
Transcend the genre. As do the best superhero movies, frankly.
Wait, to be sure.
But the bad ones are pretty bad. The Magnificent Seven remake is pretty bad. The original Magnificent Seven, very good film. Go back to that.
Okay.
What's your last drop,
So I've got two. There's a new museum that's opened in Philadelphia, Museum of the American Revolution, which I guess just opened this week.
It's actually officially opening next week on the 19th.
Officially opening next week. Okay, there are two sort of preview reviews then that were in the news a couple days ago. One in the Wall Street Journal and one in the New York Times. And what struck me was how different those two reviews were. The New York Times piece, you know, said the museum went in and tried to sort of explain the complexity of the revolution as scholars now understand it, so that the revolution was, you know, a complicated and contested event in which some people who were living in the 13 colonies benefited by gaining their independence, but some people didn't. That for some, you know, for African Americans, sometimes siding with the British is more advantageous. The, you know, the role of Native Americans, but choosing which side to fight on, these things are contested. That some people, not all men are created equal. These kinds of, you know, issues that are I think very present in the ways in which we understand the revolution. So that was sort of the New York Times version of it. The Wall Street Journal's version essentially was this wasn't patriotic enough. They wanted the museum to reflect the sort of mythology of the American Revolution that I guess had been prevalent during maybe the bicentennial era.
We fought for freedom and the British are bad guys.
Exactly. And the British are not bad guys, I say here in British pub. It struck me just that, you know, those two papers have become even more different than they traditionally have been on terms of their ideology in recent years. But I think that's reflected in their reviews of the museum.
The Wall Street Journal one was particularly interesting because even the headline said, this museum fails to sacralize the revolution as though the job of the museum is to sacralize.
Yeah.
Which was very, and it ended on a note of saying it's not exceptional enough.
Yeah.
I mean, we've already given our views on American exceptionalism.
But I mean, the museum is located, I think, like at the site where they had the Bicentennial Visitor Center.
Yes, that's right. It's not so far from Independence Hall.
So it's near all these sort of sacred sites for the revolution, you know, and you know, the fact that they tell a complicated narrative, I think, is one that we would look at. This is great. We want a complicated narrative. We want people to go in and have their ideas, you know, changed about the revolution going through this museum and thinking about it in different ways. And
history's,
I think,
is complicated. The United States is complicated.
And I think they, you know, that's the fact that the New York Times is applauding that and the Wall Street Journal was saying that, you know, we want children to go to the museum and learn to be good, you know, Americans, and they're not getting that. I thought that was interesting. Set of ways in which, you know, the past gets used and the ways in which I think contemporary politics in some ways was sort of infused in both of those reviews. There have been stories in Perspectives for the past couple of years about the decline of the history major, that the number of students signing up for history classes as electives in the United States, the number of students choosing to major in history, it also declined fairly precipitously. There were sort of horror stories about the numbers of different institutions, about the number of the enrollment drops over the past decade. But there was an article in the Yale student newspaper this week that said that history is now, for the first time in a number of years, the most popular major for incoming Yale students. And I'm not entirely sure what to make of that, but I think some of it may have to do, in fact, with the Donald Trump's election, that history seems relevant in a way that it may not have. Politics making sense of how, you know, things develop in a particular way, and it's relevant to students maybe in a way that it wasn't as immediately relevant, you know, 6 months ago.
Well, I like to think our podcast is responsible for
that. Oh, to be sure, yes.
I mean,
Yale incoming freshmen have done this because they listened to the podcast and they said, well, we can't go to Edinburgh. Yale's good enough. We'll go to Yale.
Well, I think it's interesting, David, because, I mean, you're right. I mean, I think people have started to think about history. I know that visitorship at Monticello, for example, where I know a lot of people, is up, for example. So I think people might be thinking more historically. Mm-hmm. As our friend and former colleague Tom Devine likes to say, history is the mother of all disciplines. So maybe people are returning to first principles.
Mother of all bombs, mother of all disciplines. That's good.
It was interesting because I, when I was at the Stanford Humanities Center over the past month, I did speak to some of the historians there about their own institutions, and I asked them about numbers. And even at a place like Stanford, the number of history majors is down. Interestingly, as you'll know, we're not down here. The number of majors has been steady and increasing.
We've had issues where we had too many students, which is Now, granted, we admit people differently, and there's all kinds of reasons behind that.
But then our number of majors have and
applicants have been
have held steady or risen.
That's all because of you, Frank. They heard about you.
Yeah, it's time to wrap this up.
All right. So you can follow us on Twitter. We're at Whiskey Rebel Pod. We're nearly at 1,000 followers now. So if you want to be the 1,000th follower with all the honor that attaches to that, please do so. Also, we got a Facebook page. You can like us on Facebook. We're hoping people can leave reviews on iTunes. We're nearing the end of our book giveaway deadline. So go ahead and leave a review on iTunes, but only if it's nice. Until next time, cheers, Frank.
Cheers, David.